Good evening. Have a new face tonight. Have you been here before?
A few times.
I thought you had, but it's been a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome back. Let's do introductions around.
Emily. Kurt.
Yvonne.
Gustavo.
Don.
Samuel.
Forrest.
Bob.
Jeffrey.
Wendy.
Ross.
Donovan.
Angie. It's nice to see you, Yvonne. So we've been doing this sutra for a long time. I don't even know how long anymore. It's been so long. And so I want to wrap it up tonight. I think this will be a relief to some of us, at least. And I hope nobody is going to be offended. But it's long, and it's very analytical, and it's repetitious. So it seems like we pretty much have got the drift of it, if not the the actual ability to maybe teach it to someone else. Except that if we take it to heart rather than in the analytical way, it can be shared everywhere. So I think understanding the basics of this Lankavatara Sutra is important for understanding ourselves better. And that's the point of it. It's trying to explain what we are. It's sort of like taking a strange animal and taking it apart bit by bit and saying, well, it's got four legs and it's got a nose and it has whiskers and or in this case it says it's got a body and it's got feelings and it can see and feel and it's got eyes and nose. It actually is analyzing the body of us. And then the consciousness. And of course, that's the most crucial part of it, is the consciousness that goes with the five skandhas. The last skandha is consciousness, form, feeling, perception, impulses, and consciousness. Those all describe the us. You can't say the person exactly, but you can say it's a human being. It's a being. And each one of us is that kind of being. But then there are the three kinds of consciousness that go beyond that, so that there are actually eight consciousnesses, or eight of these, of this stretch of description. So that after that, there's the part of the mind that takes all the perceptions that come in and puts it together into some sort of description and sends it up to the self-conscious part that then pulls out of the last part, the eighth part, whatever memories and decisions and observations and judgments she's ever made in her whole life to apply it to that. So we carry this barn around full of all of our experiences and all of our culture, everything we've ever learned and been taught. And that's the Alyavijnana, the storehouse consciousness. And the Alyavijnana is the one that we call samsara, the world of our suffering, because it seems so gloomy and so difficult when we sit down and really see how our mind is working. So much of it is stressed and painful and full of hard memories and difficulties and confusion, lots and lots of confusion, as well as very bright and brilliant moments and even blissful moments. It's very interesting and a powerful experience to sit down and just experience the mind as we are, without laying anything on it, just letting it be what it is. So the encouragement of the Lanka is for us to explore this barn and get to know it well. It's full, they say sometimes it's full of seeds, that the actual stuff isn't there, but the seeds, the various kinds of seeds of all of our experience can be, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, can be watered by our attention and pulled out by our self-consciousness and made into something, made into what the Lanka calls a projection. So as long as we are caught by the sense of self, the self-consciousness, we can't get away from the view of bewilderment in our mind. Our self-consciousness is really a block to our freedom. So although we talk about no self, in here Buddha goes on to talk about, well, there really are characteristics. He said each one has characteristics, and they're each different for each one. So it's not that you throw yourself away or your personality away or anything like that. It's just that you don't have to think of yourself as somebody special, or the center of your experience. Which is our tendency, of course. We're born and here we are. And of course, ultimately, we're the only one. What we experience is all that we know. So we get into a quandary in this kind of study. How can we be unselfconscious and experience things without being taking it personally? And the Lanka says, you know, if you study the Aliya Vijnana, if you study how your mind and body is working, and where you're getting your ideas, and how you're doing, how you're operating, that you'll start to understand how it works and how you don't need to take it personally, whatever it is, that none of it is personal. In fact, it's not real in the way that we think it's real, that we project from here out there as if everything out there were real, and that there was some real thing here. But actually, it's just this moment that's real. And that's what the Lanka emphasizes also, what the Buddha emphasizes. So what I did was go through the Lanka and pull out my favorite things that it said, and thought I'd share some of it with you. Not all of it. It's turned out to be many pages, surprisingly. But the emphasis, first, the whole idea of projection, which is emphasized over and over, that we project with our minds. We are creating stumbling blocks by projecting everything. Projection in Latin, it's based on Latin, and the pro means forward, or progress or propelled. And lect, ject, there are all kinds of jects in English. Inject and reject and subject, and you can think of a dozen, I bet. And so it means to throw. Inject means to push in. Subject means to push under. Project means to propel forward, throw ahead, or proceed forward. And proceeding forward is exactly the opposite of how we can experience reality. If we're proceeding forward, we're not able to be where we are. We're already somewhere else, either in our imagination, in our mind, or in our actual place of place. So, the teaching, according to Red Pine, the two main threads through the sutra are that external objects are perceptions of one's own mind. They're not out there, they're in here. And that our effort as bodhisattvas is to realize Buddha knowledge. Buddha knowledge. And that's the emphasis, is on knowledge. What to know, what's true, to know what's real. Tathagatas consider knowledge as their real body, and so are free from projections or anything that projects, such as a self, a life, or a person, or any kind of consciousness that gives rise to forms dependent on an objective world. Thus, they are free from what projects and what is projected. Knowledge as their real body. This isn't school time knowledge. This is another kind of knowledge. The reason that bodhisattvas should study this is that seeing whatever they think of as real as not real will free them from the fabrication or projection of reality and prepare them for the personal realization of what Buddhas know. What Buddhas know. So it's Buddha knowledge. That's our real body. So whatever we think of as real, as not real. Not personal. Imagined reality arises from appearances as objects and forms of dependent reality appear, and they appear as attachment. Excuse me. I'll say it again. Imagined reality arises from appearances as objects and forms of dependent reality appear, and attachment results in two kinds. Perfected reality is the mode that's free from name or appearance or from projection. It is the realm where the personal realization of Buddha knowledge takes place and is the heart of the Tathagatagarbha. So, one of the things that happens is that we instantly name things. And if we don't know the name of something, we want to know what it is in order to know it. And in achieving this kind of knowledge of a name of something, we lose the sense the unspoken sense of what it really is. We put a label, attach it to even someone as close as our sister or brother, and think we know them. Oh, it's Susie. Or it's Susie again. And it's always in our mind the same Susie. While Susie is this very, very incredible, changing, brilliant, dynamic, something. So, perfecting our reality means that we see through the names. Doesn't mean we don't have names for things, but if we attach to the names and assume that we know what it is, that already is a projecting a reality that is not real. In our life, it means that we are more likely to be curious and ask questions and listen than it is to pontificate in order to find out what's really here. Who are you? What do you mean? What is it? Rather than just living on the surface with the names of things and the appearances of things. And then they go a great deal into words, which is another part of the naming of things, because we imagine that words, and we say, I read it in the newspaper, so it has to be true. It had a whole page or two pages, so it really has to be real. But it's just all words. And we can't trust any of the words to be real and true. Even if we try to go and seek out the truth and do the same kind of research, we still don't really know. Buddha says words are not connected to anything other than the imagination that gives rise to them, and they're not essential for communication in this or in other worlds. And I think this is really important. The foolish are misled by delusion. Lesser practitioners try to annihilate it, and the wise transform it into suchness. In the background here is Buddha's teaching that beyond the mind there are no things, and beyond things there's no mind. There's no way to annihilate what's happening in our mind. The wise transform what we meet into suchness. Suchness meaning zazen mind. The selfless mind of sitting. The mind that drops off all the self-concerns, the stories, that in Zazen we over and over rediscover the rest of our mind, the quiet part, the still part, the part that sustains us. Is us. Transcending projection does not mean going beyond it, for there's no place to leave and no place to go to. There is nothing outside of suchness. So for all our running around, for all our busy minds, there's nothing outside of it. Projections, such as projections of what grasps or what is grasped, do not arise in suchness. So this grasping is a kind of definition of us in our bewilderment, that we are graspers. And deeply desiring of what we grasp. And that, too, is a root of our confusion. But in suchness, there's no need. In suchness, there's trust. To those who see that everything is still, there are no characteristics on continuity or non-continuity. But it is due to the non-arising of projections that bodhisattvas see that everything is still. When you see that whatever exists or does not exist is simply a perception of your own mind, and without form, continuities become still. Enlightenment is neither inside the skandhas nor outside them, nor both inside and outside them, nor other than the skandhas. There's no place to go. Sages and fools alike experience arising and cessation. Therefore, practitioners who cultivate the personal realization of Buddha knowledge dwell in the bliss of whatever is present and do not abandon their practice. Repository consciousness, seen by Shravakas, is essentially pure. But because it's obscured by the dust of sensation, it appears impure. This is the barn. But to Tathagatas, the realm that appears before them, this realm, is like an amala fruit in the palm of their hand, a fruit like a jewel. As practitioners cultivate the realm of personal realization, they transcend views of eternity and annihilation and existence and non-existence and dwell in the bliss of meditating on what is present and what appears before them. This is associated with the realm of form, not desire. Well, I think I'll end it here with the very last chapter, or the last section, which is very different from the rest of it, in which Buddha says, there are countless reasons why you should not eat meat, and then proceeds to tell a lot of reasons why one should not eat meat. So, as you know and have seen, this is a very odd work, very ancient work, and has a great deal to tell us. I have thought that this samadhi, this selflessness, is about what we feel in situations where we naturally don't think about ourselves. When we're at a wedding, or childbirth, or some event that takes us out of ourself. And usually those events are not just happy events, but very poignant, very not exactly sad, but they're very, very touching. And they touch something in us so that we come away from a wedding or a funeral or some event, some special event, feeling transformed in some way, in a different state of mind. And I think that's what this is pointing to. It's not some special, unfamiliar thing that we have to drum up somewhere inside ourselves. It's what we naturally are, and override with our enthusiasm and busyness until we begin to ask questions about ourselves and to study ourselves and to see what else is here besides the obvious. So I'm not sure this is answering your question, but I certainly gave it a great deal of thought, because that's the essence of it, of course, is how to live on two edges rather than just one, to be the knowledge of Zazen as your reality, as the truth of it, so that this isn't a pretend thing we're doing, and it isn't something that it only happens here, but this is a happening that is pointing to what we are in the onlyness of our being. In one sense, in the solitude of our being, in the sense of reality, and yet the complete, utter connection of everything at the same time. So, there's a couple of minutes for questions. Forrest?
Do you think that part about not eating meat will add it in later?
It sure looks like it, though.
I mean, he ate, right, the historical Buddha?
Well, apparently so, yeah.
I heard that's how he died. Made possible.
Yes.
That's just a long time ago.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't strike me, just from what we may know of him, as a do as I say, not as I do kind of guy.
Well, Red Pine says that he does a sort of wrench to it and makes it fit, but I don't know. I don't know where it comes from, really.
I understand the idea. It's something I thought of. I was vegan for a while, but I forget which philosopher it is, but it's the thing where if everyone can't do it, then you shouldn't either. I forget what it's called. I don't know if anyone remembers, but it's just a way of living where you have to ask yourself, if this is okay for everyone, then you know, I should do it. If it's not, though, in our world, we cannot survive if everyone was vegan. We would starve.
I see.
So, I don't know. And I just can't see anyone begging and just saying, you know, well, not this or this, but I'll take anything else. You
know? Oh, that's not how it works, unfortunately.
So I wonder about that. I mean, I certainly think there's parts that it's good to be aware of, but like you say about living on two edges. You know, it's how do we take some of the teachings and all of those things and integrate it into our practical, everyday, working American lives?
Yes.
So, you know, that's a very practical kind of consideration. It's like, well, how should I eat? What should I eat?
That's right.
Yeah, it's confusing.
One of our many decisions. Want to live?
So I could stand up and applaud. But thank you for the summary and the conclusion and the wrap up. Actually, makes kind of sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much.
Good. Well, we'll have to decide what to do next. I think we have a list somewhere.
Precepts.
Precepts? Oh, yes, we did say precepts. Yes, I did. Thank you. Yeah, I'll bring some handouts next week. And, my favorite subject. So we have a business meeting tonight, so we should probably proceed to that.